Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again criticizes the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams Israeli airstrikes on Gaza City and stresses that the attacks strengthen its resolve to fight for Palestinian rights. And several cases of the British coronavirus variant are confirmed in France and Spain. Welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has lashed out at the United States for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Rouhani said the U.S. has caused trouble for Iran to acquire vaccines through what he called wicked activities. He said Iran will do its utmost to obtain an effective and reliable vaccine despite American sanctions. The president assured that Iran has installed the proper equipment to store any type of COVID-19 vaccine. Tehran has time and again complained that U.S. financial sanctions are blocking its access to drug and medical supplies. International lawyer Barry Grossman says the U.S. has made no effort to facilitate Iran's access to medicine and humanitarian goods.
The problem, of course, is while they pay lip service not embargoing the sale of humanitarian goods to Iran, they've made no effort to facilitate the financial transactions that go with the acquisition of such products, be it medicine or other humanitarian goods. And therefore, it's virtually impossible for Iran to purchase what is needed in a timely manner. And it's worth remembering that it was only late in 2018, October of 2018, that the International Court of Justice ordered the U.S. To lift the sanctions insofar as it restricted Iran's ability to acquire humanitarian goods, medicines, and products relating to the aviation industry. The U.S. response to that was to give notice to withdraw from the treaty. But we come back to the problem at hand, and it's very interesting. We often hear the United States trying to explain its hostile position to Iran as an attempt to what the U.S. would call liberate Iranians from an oppressive regime, which is, of course, nonsense. But this action shows this contempt for the health and well-being and the very lives of the most vulnerable in Iranian society shows that the U.S. couldn't care less about the Iranian people.
Well, Iran has extended a nighttime traffic curfew to low-risk cities to sustain a recent fall in daily coronavirus infections and deaths. A spokesman for Iran's coronavirus task force says the curfew has already been in place for more than 100 cities labeled at medium risk. Alireza Raisi says the measures will now be implemented in 330 more cities with lower risk of coronavirus. Now, the curfew bans the use of private cars from 9 p.m. until 4 a.m. It came into effect on November the 21st. The curfew helped reduce Iran's virus deaths from their peak of over 400 per day. On Saturday, the country reported 134 new fatalities and over 5,700 infections, both are record lows since the start of the curfew. More European countries have confirmed their first cases of a new COVID variant that has recently emerged in Britain. Spain and Sweden have become the latest countries to detect the virus on their soil. Spain says four cases have been confirmed in Madrid, while tests have been carried out for three more suspected ones. On Friday, in French capital Paris, it also confirmed its first case. All the patients had arrived in the three countries from the UK. Several other states, including Japan and Germany, have already detected the new COVID strand, despite travel bans on the UK. Now, British authorities say the new variant spreads far more quickly than the previous one. Well, the number of deaths from the coronavirus has surpassed 190,000 in Brazil as the fast-spreading disease continues to rage across the country. The Brazil Health Ministry reported nearly 500 fatalities and nearly 23,000 new cases on Saturday. Brazil has over 7.4 million infections. In Mexico, more than 9,600 people contracted the virus during the last 24 hours. It also registered more than 665 new fatalities, pushing the overall death toll to nearly 122,000. Mexico has already started mass coronavirus vaccinations, along with several other Latin American countries. In the United States, the number of fatalities has surpassed 330,000, while its total cases are nearing 19 million. The U.S. remains the world's hit country by the pandemic. A black physician in the U.S. died from COVID-19 last week. 2 weeks before her death, she posted a video on Facebook complaining of what she called racist hospital care. Now, that comes as anti-racism sentiments run high in the U.S. following a number of incidents showing inequality between black and white people.
This is how black people get killed. When you send them home and they don't know how to fight for themselves. I had to talk to somebody, maybe the media, somebody, to let people know how I'm being treated up in this place.
Chilling words from a well-respected doctor in the US who took to social media to vent her frustration at not being taken seriously by white doctors at Indiana University Hospital. However, just 1 month after this video was posted on social media, Dr. Susan Moore was discharged against her will and sadly succumbed to the coronavirus, leaving behind a son and many grieved friends and colleagues. Her concern was made all the more clear when she stated that she no longer trusted the medical team responsible for her care, stating that the bedside manner displayed was not how patients should be treated. Dr. Moore, herself a trained and practicing medical doctor, complained of several examples as to why she was not being treated correctly, including being refused antiviral drugs, being made to wait long periods, and having to beg for a CT scan on her chest, proving that her symptoms were real. The doctor on the case stated that he was uncomfortable in prescribing drugs to her, making Dr. Moore feel like an addict, sparking Dr. Moore to react by saying that this is how black people are being killed in the American care system. It seems that this is not a one-off case in the US, so why then does it take a high-profile case such as Dr. Susan Moore to raise awareness of just how black people are being treated so unfairly in the United States of America?
The case of the black physician who recently passed away and experienced discrimination in the US hospital after experiencing COVID-19 is a perfect example of the systemic racism that is embedded into the U.S. healthcare system. The U.S. healthcare system was built on the back of exploitation of black and brown people. And in fact, a lot of vaccines and a lot of medicines were first tested on enslaved black people in the U.S. South, in the United States, prior to being released to the general public.
Well, it's not just about healthcare system where black people are unfairly treated in the U.S. Similar cases can be seen when it comes to education and employment, among other things. That leaves America a racially divided nation. It seems that racial segregation is still evident in the U.S., with the administration of outgoing President Donald Trump endorsing it. Now, one of the legacies Trump will leave behind is how he increased the black and white divide with his actions.
Very sadly for a nation that prides itself on the land of the free and the land of opportunity, it seems that some people are more free than others, as the US has become very Orwellian in its perception of racial freedom. The Black Lives Matter movement proved that a range of institutions is deliberately targeting the black community, imposing inequality around every corner for those who come from black and non-white backgrounds. Yet when it comes to COVID-19, Dr. Moore's story is all too common on the wards and in the emergency rooms of the US, with the coronavirus disproportionately affecting black people in the country. In fact, Black patients are being hospitalized at four times the rate of white patients across certain medical institutions. And within the poorer areas of the US, figures show that over 70% of COVID-19 cases are within black communities, suggesting very little is being done by the authorities to stop the spread in these areas. The clear reason behind this is the institutional racism that's rooted deep within the heart of the US, raising the question as to whether this is something that's always existed, increased under the presidency of Donald Trump, and whether a new president can start a new chapter in racial equality when Joe Biden enters the White House.
In order for the situation of healthcare for black, Latino, indigenous people in the United States to improve, there needs to be a total restructuring of not only the U.S. healthcare system, but the U.S. economic system. In the United States, you are not a patient at a hospital, you are a customer. If you don't have insurance, you're out of luck and you're not going to receive the help that you need. And we've seen this countless times over and over, especially with COVID, where we have high death rates among the black community, the Latino community, the indigenous community. Biden, Joe Biden, the president-elect of the United States, will definitely not improve the healthcare situation because he's backed by some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies that have created this very system.
Moving on to other news this hour, the Israeli regime has carried out fresh airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas of the besieged Palestinian coastal enclave. In a statement, the Israeli military said its warplanes hit three Hamas targets early on Saturday. It claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas denounced the attacks, which targeted a children's hospital and also rehabilitation center there. It underlined that such moves would not break Palestinians' will, but rather strengthen their resistance and resolve to fight for their legitimate rights. The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing similar accusations. Earlier, our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shana, gave us more details on the Israeli attacks.
Israeli fighter jets attacked central Gaza and also the eastern part of Gaza City. During this airstrike, Israeli fighter jets damaged the children's hospital and also damaged a center that treats the disabled. At least one child was injured. Israeli fighter jets used at least six rockets against the Gaza Strip and also used artillery fire to attack areas in the east of Deir el-Balah. This has been a grim reminder to people of Gaza of the 2008 war. Around this time, 2008, Israel waged a 22-day war on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of people in the tiny enclave. Since then, Israel waged two more wars and caused huge destruction, a huge loss of life for nearly 2 million people in the Gaza Strip.
Well, the Syrian Foreign Ministry has slammed Israel's latest attack on the country, saying such acts of aggression will not go without consequences. The remarks came in a letter sent to the United Nations Secretary General and the President of the UN Security Council in reaction to Israel's Friday airstrikes in Hama countryside. Now, the letter stressed that continuous support from the United States and some members of the Council has encouraged Israel to push ahead with its aggressive approach. Damascus condemned Israel's attacks as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council resolutions. It also called on the Council to assume its responsibility in preventing Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, Russia criticized Israel's airstrikes on Syria, saying such actions, quote, further destabilize the complicated regional situation. Political commentator Michael Springman says the United Nations remains silent despite Israeli continued aggression.
It's another outrage committed by the apartheid entity that calls itself Israel, and it's done only because the United States supports that illegitimate entity, and the United Nations, which in by and large is the creature of the United States, will take no action because it fears American pressure, it fears loss of money from the United States, and because the United States is a permanent member of the Security Council and can block any kind of resolution. It's unconscionable. The Israelis flew over Beirut in Lebanon, striking at Syria, claiming they were attacking, depending on which Israeli newspaper you read, the weapons production facility in Syria, or they were attacking Iran-supported military groups in the area. Christmas Eve attacks, of course, it's a there are a number of Christians in Lebanon and in Syria, and it's a time for them of preparing for a great feast day, and they were scared out of their wits by the low-flying jets and the huge explosions.
Johanna Butt in Kashmir says the Indian government's detention of Kashmir's political leaders prevents people there from deciding their own future.
On one side, you're letting the entire world know that the situation in Kashmir is normal and normalcy has returned and electoral processes and democratic processes are happening in the region. And on the other hand, this crackdown. So a kind of a confusion and a chaos in the region where you're not allowing people to democratically choose and democratically decide their future. So this has been happening in Kashmir for the last many years now, and people of Kashmir have time and again wanted New Delhi to resolve the matter once and for all again. But after 2019, August 5, things have drastically changed because New Delhi stripped Kashmir's autonomous status, and after that, all the political processes in the region were halted, and because of the halt in the political process, people of Kashmir were not given a chance to interfere or to get involved in any decision-making about the region of Kashmir. So New Delhi is taking decisions on its own. It's a kind of one-sided decisions happening at a time, and people of Kashmir are not being given a fair chance to decide or to participate in any, whether it be political or administrative or related to legalities of the land.
The first anniversary of the U.S.'s assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon, General Qasem Soleimani, is just around the corner. Correspondents in Afghanistan, Lebanon, and Yemen have talked to a number of people in those countries about his assassination. Let's take a listen.
The assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has not largely affected Iran's regional policies. The U.S. had thought that it could challenge Iran by assassinating the general, but it failed to do so. Likewise, the Islamic Republic has pressed ahead with its policies in the region.
General Soleimani was a key figure in combating terrorism and had a very active role in this regard. The United States assassinated him because it was aware of that fact.
Commander Soleimani was a devout Muslim who sacrificed his most precious possessions in order to protect and resurrection his nation and his people. He did most give the humiliation until he rose to the rank of martyr.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani represented a great loss to the Islamic nation, as he was an example to be followed for the axis of resistance in the Middle East.
The killing of Soleimani was a loss to all Muslims. Whenever a hero goes, there are other people who continue the path of resistance. God willing, we will win.
This martyrdom proves the tyrannical and aggressive nature of the U.S. administration and also shows that resistance is deeply rooted in the hearts and minds of people. Whoever thinks that by killing a leader they can extinguish the flame of resistance, they are wrong.
And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Canadians are joining the criminal army of the Israeli regime and putting themselves in the service of war crimes to which they can be held liable, says Nora Barris Friedman Ryder in an article titled "Israeli Regime Illegally Recruits Canadian Citizens to Its Army." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Human rights activists are demanding an end to the Israeli regime military recruitment of Canadians, which violates the laws of that country. The Canadian government has so far refused to enforce its laws, allowing the Zionist regime to continue the practice. Canadians joined Zionist militias during the Nakba, the forced expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in 1947 and 1948. The Zionist regime army has boasted in recent years that it has enlisted hundreds of Canadian citizens to its occupation military, joining other foreigners, including those from the U.S. The CBC reported last year that Canadian government agencies do not keep track of how many of its citizens join the Israeli regime army. Last year, the Zionist regime's consulate in Toronto said that a representative of its military would be interviewing potential recruits. Legal experts say this is a violation of the Foreign Enlistment Act, which prohibits a foreign state from enlisting Canadian citizens into its armed forces. The act, which passed in 1937, was originally an anti-communist measure to criminalize Canadians who traveled to Spain to help fight against the fascist Franco dictatorship. In mid-October, 170 prominent Canadian faith leaders, activists, artists, and intellectuals called on Justice Minister David Lametti to investigate and potentially take legal action against all those involved in the recruiting and encouraging recruiting in the country for the Israeli regime army. In addition to the prominent Canadian signatories, scholar Noam Chomsky, Pink Floyd Roger Waters, filmmaker Ken Loach, Nobel Peace Laureate Meredith McGuire and journalist Chris Hedges signed the letter. John Pilpot, a criminal litigation attorney and international law expert, filed a formal complaint with Lametti over the Zionist regime's recruitment within Canada. Such recruitment is a crime under the Criminal Code of Canada, Pilpot told the electronic Antifaza. Pilpot also called on Lametti to investigate Deborah Lyons, Canada's ambassador to the occupied Palestine, who held a party at the country's embassy in Tel Aviv to honor its citizens serving in the Israeli regime army. Only 33 of the 78 Canadian citizens in the Israeli regime army were able to attend the January event. Many were unavailable because they were deployed to the Golan Heights, Syrian territory occupied by the Zionist regime, and along the Gaza boundary, Canada's defense attache told media. We consider that Lyons potentially is encouraging people to join the Israeli regime army and could be charged, Pilpot said. Nearly 1,500 people have sent letters to the Lametti demanding that recruiting schemes be stopped. Lametti deferred responsibility to the police. It is necessary that the diplomats from another country, therefore the diplomats of Israel who are here, follow Canadian law, he said. It is up to the police investigators to decide whether there have been offenses and, if there is one, for the prosecutor to proceed with formal charges. Following Justice Minister Lametti's response,
Phil Putt sent a complaint to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in early November. The RCMP acknowledged receipt of the complaint, according to Phil Putt. Canada's pro-Israeli regime policies, including its opposition to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement for Palestinian rights, are out of step with public opinion. A September poll found that 86% of Canadians do not want the Israeli regime to be held to a different standard than other countries. The fact that illegal recruiting by Israeli regime can happen here with impunity is a reflection of the overall situation. Bruce Katz, co-president of the group Palestinian and Jewish Unity, told the electronic Intifada, "We are dealing with a very well-organized, well-funded machine," Katz added, referring to the Israeli regime lobby groups that have a distorting influence over Canadian policy. They can be held liable. Phil Putt said that leaders of schools who promote a student enlistment into the Israeli regime army could be liable to charges. Various lone soldier programs attract and sponsor international recruits to the Zionist regime military. As reporter Yves Engler has noted, some Jewish schools in Toronto, for example, incorporate promotion of the Zionist regime troops and army officials into their curricula. The Zionist regime lobby groups also promote the regime's military propaganda at Canadian universities. In November 2019, Palestine rights activists were physically attacked by far-right extremists at York City in Toronto when they protested an event glorifying Israeli regime troops. The event featuring reservists on duty, a group created to defend the Zionist regime army and counter the Israeli regime boycott movement at university campuses, was hosted by Herut, a Canadian Zionist organization. The organizers billed the event as an opportunity to hear from real Zionist regime troops. Phil Putt said that human rights advocates should continue to document and protest these recruitment schemes. Canadians are joining a criminal army and putting themselves in the service of war crimes to which they can be held liable, Phil Putt warned.
Africa Today.
Iranians have a long history of ties with the East African coast. The most significant aspect of these relations is the immigration of a group of Iranians from Shiraz to the coast and islands of East Africa about 1,000 years ago.
The main substantial explanation comes from the Kilwa Chronicle. One important information that comes from this Portuguese chronicle is that the people who came, they were Iranians. That is very clear because it says that they are from Shiraz, led by Ali bin Hassan.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenyam, and welcome to this edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the historical immigration of Shirazis from Iran to the East African coasts. We shall briefly look at how this movement influenced the formation of the Swahili culture and civilization. We are also asking what efforts are being made to preserve this tangible heritage. And as you watch, let us know what you think by sending us your views and comments through our email handle, and stay tuned till the end.
Iranian immigrants in East Africa. African traditional history recognizes early connections with the Persian Gulf. The most pervasive are stories of origin from Shiraz. Historical accounts tell of the voyage of seven ships manned by a father who left Shiraz with his six sons for East Africa. He later established permanent settlements across a vast region of the eastern coast of Africa. These Iranians from Shiraz had deep and long-standing social and cultural impacts on indigenous people of East and Southern East African coasts. Many elements of Iranian culture and civilization are still visible in parts of today's Somalia, Kenya, Tanzania, Mozambique, and the Comoros.
The cultural heritage of Shirazis who settled in East Africa include the celebration of Nowruz, prevalence of Iranian architecture, and the massive influence of Persian in Kiswahili, the main language spoken by East Africans. To discuss the historical immigration of Shirazis from Iran to East Africa, we are joined here in the studio by Professor Amir Bahram Arab Ahmadi. He's a historian and the head of the Central and Southern Africa Studies Department at the University of Tehran. Also joining us from Tanzania is Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar. Professor Abdul Sharif's current research interest is on the history of Zanzibar, the Swahili coast, and the Indian Ocean. We start off with Professor Arab Ahmadi. Thanks a lot for joining us today in our program.
Thank you very much. This is a great pleasure of mine to be with you in this program for some minutes.
We're also happy to host you. Now, to start off, Professor Arab Ahmadi, now, can you tell us briefly about the immigration of Iranians to East Africa, particularly the Shirazis?
Yes, of course, before migration of Shirazis to East Africa, which resulted to permanent settlements of them in that part of Africa for quite a number of centuries, we have had some other historical contact between Iran and East Africa, which goes back to ancient era, to actually the time of Achaemenid dynasty and Sassanids.
Okay.
But talking about migration of Shirazis to East African coast,
and settlement,
which can be considered as one of the most historical events which has happened between Iran and East Africa in particular. Very briefly, I can tell you this historical migration has been taking place in 10th century during the time of Al-Buyer dynasty in Iran, in some part of Iran. Under the leadership of someone known as Prince Ali ibn Hassan Shirazi, who was then governor of Fars province. And of course, Shiraz was the capital of Fars province. They migrated to East African coast and settled in a narrow area from today's southern shores of Somali right up to northern today's Mozambique, including today's Kenya, of course, coastal area
coastal
islands
areas.
Only.
Yeah.
Today's Kenya, Tanzania, Zanzibar archipelago, as well as Comoros archipelago.
Okay.
Yeah, and they made, as I mentioned, and you mentioned too, they established permanent settlement in quite number of islands and coastal area, something between 50 up to 80 location.
Thank you very much, Professor Arab Ahmadi, for that concise introduction. Now, the Swahili language obtained many vocabularies from Persian language. Persian poets influenced the Swahili literature through their classic works. The influence of Persian architecture is seen in Shirazi building style throughout East African coastal towns, including Lamu. Actually, Lamu is the oldest and best preserved Swahili settlement in East Africa. The influence of Persian architecture is also clearly visible in former Swahili city-states, including Mombasa, Zanzibar, and Kilwa. Founded in the 40th century, the Great Mosque of Kilwa was one of the major Persian heritage sites in Tanzania.
Two important structures dating from this era still stand. The first is the Great Mosque, which was built in the 14th century and was once the largest mosque in sub-Saharan Africa. The other is the palace at Husuni Kubwa, built between 1315 and 1330, and renowned for its spectacular pools and courtyards.
Now let's bring in Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar. Thank you for your time, Professor Abdul Sharif. We have heard from Dr. Arab Ahmadi here how Shirazis moved to East Africa. Now, do we still have ethnic Iranian Shirazis in East Africa?
When they came to East Africa, they intermarried with the local people. And in fact, we have writing one of the oldest traditions, the Kilwa tradition, a chronicle, in which it says that Hassan bin Ali, the person who came so many centuries ago, married the daughter of the local chief. And therefore, his children then became legitimate from his side as well as from the mother's side. So what we should expect is not to find community of Persian-looking people now remaining exclusive somewhere. They have intermarried for 1,000 years now. And so you'll find them from brown to black. But you ask them, what is your origin? They'll say, we are Shirazi. And they will recount their history. So in that sense, they are Shirazi, not racially, but because they have been mixed for 1,000 years.
Thank you for that, Professor Abdul Sharif, a leading historian and researcher in Tanzania.
The Shirazis brought Persian traditions and customs to East Africa. They also intermarried with the local communities. Kiswahili, the language of the East African coastal regions, contains many Persian loan words. The Kiswahili language is now not just confined to East Africa after being declared an official language of the African Union.
And now we are back to the studio with our guest, Professor Arab Ahmadi. Professor, can you elaborate to us on how the Shirazis impacted on the culture of East Africans?
Yeah, this is a very deep question and, of course, should have an extensive answer.
Yeah.
To be honest, due to long-standing settlement of Shirazis in East African coast and island, approximately 500 years, and, of course, since they established a very friendly relation with, I mean, indigenous people of East African coast, through intermarriage, and of course, based on equality, which was very, very important for Africans, they transferred either directly or indirectly some part of Iranian culture and, of course, customs to East African indigenous people.
Okay.
For example, they have been very influential for enrichment of Kiswahili language. Right now, there have been more than 500 Persian words which have been inherited and now used in day-to-day interaction by Swahili-speaking people. Either those who, Swahili language is considered as their first language or second language, no different. And, you know, this reality has been recognized by Swahili Academy of Kenya and Tanzania. Apart from Persian votes, we will see strong traces of Persian or Farsi literature on Swahili literature. Some great Iranian poets such as Sa'di, Ferdowsi, Khayyam, and Hafez have been influential, of course, indirectly to Swahili culture and Swahili literature. If we have a look at, for example, Utenzi, or for example, Fiumu Lungu Legend, or Inkishafi, we will see a type of inspiration that those who made such this legend and books have received from Iranian literature. And of course, definitely, Shirazi had been actually link of, you know, this cultural and literary proximity.
Professor Arab Ahmadi, can you briefly also elaborate on the impact of Shirazi architecture, especially in the construction of mosques in East Africa?
Yes, thank you very much. Very good question. We will see the deep influence of Shirazis in East African coast in particular in the form of construction of mosques and, of course, stone building. For example, if we have a look to Kilwagan Mosque or Hosni Kubra Palace or Hosni Ndogo or some mausoleum attribute to Shirazi kings, we will see exactly the presence and prevalence of Iranian architectural style, for example, in terms of arc, which has been used, for example, columns, bricks, for example, domes, that for the first time was used in the history of East African coast, and of course, installation of long columns on the top of some mausoleums. All are representing the existence of Iranian architectural style.
Thanks a lot. Actually, there's a lot more to discuss on this topic. Now, we're also going to get some comments from Professor Abdul Sharif of Zanzibar on how Shirazis contributed to the culture and civilization of East Africa.
Went further, specifically to be Iranian. They seem to have probably introduced Farsi words, for example, into Kiswahili, the words in Kiswahili, which are very distinctly Persian rather than Arabic. We have the word in Kiswahili for factories is karkhana, which is obviously Farsi.
Iranian immigrants in East Africa.
Back to the studio here with our guest, Professor Arab Ahmadi. Now, you've lived in Tanzania for some years, and you witnessed the Mwaka Kogwa celebration in Zanzibar. How similar is it to the Nowruz here in Iran?
Yeah, I do remember when I was in Tanzania, I had a chance once to actually participate in Mwaka Kogwa festival, which used to held every year in a certain township known as Makontochi. During that day, a lot of people are coming, not only from Zanzibar, but also from Kenya and Tanzania to watch it. Of course, answering to first part of your question, as I mentioned, celebration of Nowruz, which means a new day, and we actually celebrate it at the beginning of new Iranian year or new solar year. Was introduced by Shirazis to indigenous people of East African coast and island, and was accepted by them. And they kept it and preserved it as a part of their own tradition, even after eradication of Shirazi kingdom. They kept it and preserved it. And of course, they continue to celebrate it year after year until now. But to be honest, the Nowruz celebration that we are celebrating in Iran is to some extent different from Muaka Kopa.
Yeah.
Almost 50% of Iranian Nowruz celebration is intact, whilst from African side, they have entered some part of their own culture,
local tradition,
which they have inherited from their ancestors.
Now let's take a look at Muaka Kogwa celebrations in Zanzibar.
This is only the beginning of Muaka Kogwa ceremony. On the day of the ceremony, thousands of Zanzibari people, together with tourists and reporters from around the world, would flock to the main square of Makunduchi to watch the Muaka Kogwa, an event which is more of a fight.
Two young men from northern part of Makunduchi and two other from southern part fight using banana stems as fighting weapons. Young people from both parts of the village, along with the women, make a circle around the fighters and start singing different local songs about love and the like. Either side of the combat who feels the defeat would surrender, otherwise it would continue until one side surrenders.
About three generations ago, stones and cudgels were used as fighting weapons on the Muaka Kogwa Day. But Karume, the first president of Zanzibar after the revolution, banned the use of stones and cudgels. And banana stems replaced the cudgels to avoid the damage.
Cultural identity is important for people's sense of self and how they relate to others. A strong cultural identity can contribute to people's overall well-being. The interaction with Persians is now part of the lasting heritage of East Africans. What needs to be done to preserve these cultural heritage sites that point to the historical influence of Iranians in East Africa?
There is actually a lot of evidence of Persian connection. All over Zanzibar, in fact, all over East Africa, when you dig in any archaeological site, you find a lot of what are called Sassanid Islamic pottery. Plenty, thousands of pieces of this pottery exist, and they actually give the date of when they were imported into this area, and then, of course, buried in the ground. So all of these heritage sites should be studied by experts who are good archaeologists working with historians to do the history and whatever that has survived to be preserved in a proper way. Like I mentioned the mosque on Tumbatu Island in the north that is in ruins, and even the mihrab had fallen down.
Cultural heritage and natural history of a nation has a very high value and is unique. One of the aspirations contained in the African Union Agenda 2063 is that of an Africa with a strong cultural identity, common heritage, shared values, and ethics. Therefore, preserving the tangible heritage of the Swahili civilization is of great importance to East African countries and the African continent in general. Now, Professor Arab Ahmadi, what measures are being taken to preserve these Shirazi or Persian heritage in Tanzania and East Africa in general? And also, are you in contact with your colleagues, academic colleagues in East Africa in this regard?
Yeah, to be honest, East African people have done the best in order to preserve whatever they have inherited from Shirazis. And they have transferred, such this component as a part of their own oral culture and tradition, generation by generation.
Now, Professor, you've written several books which you've brought us to us in the studio here. Now, can you elaborate on these books and papers which you've written?
Yeah, I can say on my own part, I have tried to do whatever I could do. I have traveled several times to Tanzania, Kenya, and Zanzibar, and I have extracted a lot of, I can say, rare and unique information through my field studies. For I have communicated with some ordinary people in the coastline of Tanzania and Kenya, and I have, as I mentioned, I have extracted even some traditions from, I can say, their own hearts.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
have actually talked to them. I have listened, you know, some legend know, that they have received from their fathers, forefathers, and through this, I have tried to discover some fact which can be considered as, you know, very valuable oral literature involving about the history of Shirazi. These are some of the books, and of course, apart from this book, I have written quite a number of scholarly papers.
Thank you very much, Professor Arab Ahmadi, for your time here and your incisive analysis on the immigration of Shirazi to East Africa. And we look forward to the strengthening of the cultural and historical ties between the people of Iran and East Africa.
Thank you very much. I have to thank you and the organizer and producer of this fruitful program, which gives a lot of information about common history of Iran and East Africa.
Thank you. And that wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today, which focused on the historical ties between Iran and East Africa. We shall continue to bring you more programs on the African cultural and historical heritage in our future shows. Do let us know what you would like to see in our show. Take care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.